Isaiah chapter 43, verses 18 to 21. And this is what it says. But the Lord says, "Do not cling to events of the past, or dwell on what happened long ago. Watch for the new thing I'm going to do. It is happening already. You can see it now. I will make a road through the wilderness and give you streams of water there. Even the wild animals will honor me. Jackals and ostriches will praise me. When I make rivers flow in the desert to give water to my chosen people, they are the people I made for myself, and they will sing my praises." Okay, apologies for the slight interference there. And we could have the PowerPoint up, Jim. So I gave a version of this talk at the Watch Night service on the 31st of December, and I called it Hope rather than Remembrance. And I've been asked to bring it again, but I've reframed it as Watch for the New Thing. Now, the talk inspired Balaji to put this photo montage together to help badge our theme for the year, The Way. And then as now, I'm going to use this talk to try and look at the year ahead through the eyes of faith and of expectation, of possibility, potential, of change and improvement, to be surprised by grace, to be taken aback by God's undeserved blessing, to look beyond what we see and simply extrapolate and project. Same old, same old. And be prepared to be surprised by joy, the unexpected. And the Bible encourages us to walk by faith and not by sight. For who hopes for what they see? So watch for the new thing that God is doing. Do not get hung up on the old stories of past deliverance that define our history. God has and is doing a new thing. So what do you hope for? That was the question I asked on the 31st of December. And I'll add to that, what new thing are you watching out for? Biblical hope is different from wishing for something or simply making a resolution that may have made it past January. What is it that you hope for? Is it something tangible and real, measurable, concrete? Now, we watched three clips back in December, and I'm going to play them again today. And the first, when we Jim calls it up, is drone footage from a Russian TV flying over a Syrian city. It lasts for just a few minutes, and there's no sound. So what would hope look like for the Syrians? What new thing would be needed to rebuild their cities, to reopen schools, to repair and staff hospitals, to get the buses working again, food enough to eat? The second clip is posted on the Guardian website earlier in 2018. They, like the readers of Isaiah's prophecy that we've just heard, were people in exile who were refugees from a homeland they had lost. And these refugees were filmed on the Croatian-Slovenia border. So hope for them, the new thing to watch for, is a safe place to lay their heads, not having to move on, an opportunity to start again, to receive a place of welcome, a place of hospitality, a new home. The last clip is shot at ground level rather than from the bird's eye view of a drone, and it's of an incident in the Negev desert. So the water in the Negev was a surprise. It was captured by an Israeli cameraman in 2014. Normally, the riverbed is dry, dry sand, and a broken boulder field with empty waterfalls. And yet suddenly, the water comes pouring through. There are plenty of dry places on Earth, and it's not just a feature of global warming, not least because some places have got very wet indeed, with terrible floods. The dry places, I mean, are those situations that never seem to change. They always remain the same, stuck in the same rut, the same difficulties, where it is hard to flourish, hard to see things grow and improve. Hard places where kindness, mercy, generosity seem to be missing most, if not all, the time. Grinding places where it is hard to make a living, to make ends meet. A question of survival rather than living. Or folk trapped in circumstances they find themselves and not sure and unable to see how positive change may come. And why I like this Negev video clip is suddenly all that changes, and for a few minutes I want to reflect on God who makes a way where there is no way, where hope is more important than remembrance, and to watch for the new thing. And we will do that by looking at this passage from Isaiah. Watch for the new thing I'm going to do. It is happening already. You can see it now. I will make a road through the wilderness and give you streams of water there. Even the wild animals will honor me. Jackals and ostriches will praise me when I make rivers flow in the desert to give water to my chosen people. They are the people I made for myself, and they will sing my praises. And when Isaiah, when this was written and read, it was dark and difficult times. For many people, they were in circumstances that they had given up hope. And Isaiah is writing to people in exile, people who were powerless and unable to change much of their situation. But they were also not blameless for the pickle they were in. They'd forgotten the basics as far as God was concerned, but God had not forgotten them. Nonetheless, they were locked into a set of expectations about how things should and could change, and this was providing a real barrier for them being able to see and grasp the way forward that God was planning for them. There is both a comfort and a danger in looking back to the past as a pointer for what the future could be. Back to the glory days, to the way deliverance had happened in the past, that will make sense of the present and the way that the future will be. Now, it's important to know the past, but not to live in it. So from the reading we have read, God assured the people that he still had a plan and a purpose, and even though they had messed up, what was coming was not what they were expecting. And sometimes we think we know what God is likely to do because in similar circumstances he had worked in a particular way, and we expect God to work in that way again. And this can limit and deceive us because we find it hard to discern and understand what God is actually doing because it isn't what we expected. Now, in the previous verses, Isaiah reminded them that they were oppressed and slaves in Egypt, and God made a way by removing the water for them to walk on dry land and escape into the wilderness. The wilderness was the testing place, a place of temptation, of formation, and of shaping to become the people of God. It was to prepare them for the realities of the promised land, to build a just, faithful, and obedient people where God would be their God and they would be his people, to be a light to the nations, as a witness and a worshipping community as to what God is and was like, and to follow in his ways. And this time round, as God's people, he would take them out of the scorn and disgrace and the disaster and the failure of defeat, of exile, to be redeemed and restored. This time, God would make a way through the desert, the wilderness, a wilderness where there was no water. Except this time, God would put the water back in. Not just in flash floods or oases or water from the rock and the arguments over food and water that marked and disfigured the Hebrews' passage through different sets of desert from Egypt. This time round, in the wilderness, there will be streams. There will be rivers. Rivers of flowing water that would allow the people returning from exile in Babylon to flourish in the wilderness. The way back is being restored and redeemed. And it was the willingness to trust God on the road into the dry, difficult, marginal places, the hard places, relying on God, that is precisely in those unpromising lands that would be the promise of life. Now, there are various ways that this passage can be read, but I would suggest that one way of reading this is through an eschatological lens, looking to times that were spoken about beyond the immediate return from Babylon into the future. Not least because, as far as we know, when the Jews did go back, it was staggered over many years. It was piecemeal, and on occasions they had military escorts. And although God provided for them in that way, as far as we know, the miraculous streams did not appear in the desert as they dribbled back to Jerusalem. Yet the picture of water is not just about a God who creates clouds, rivers, rains and streams, the physical means of life, but the spiritual too. The promises of the Spirit that gives life. Now, the Spirit that brings new life and commitment, fruit and blessing points to the Messiah and to the age of the Spirit, where Jesus calls out on the last day of the feast to come and drink from the living water he himself supplies. And alongside this promise of water in the desert are those on the margins. In the language of the poem, the doleful creatures of the night get caught up as well in the blessings of God in the wilderness, in the wild places of earth, as they are transformed. Now, ostriches have a bad reputation. They were depicted as cruel mothers, as highlighted in Job chapter 39, who seems to have been a bit of a naturalist. And he observed, the ostrich leaves her eggs on the ground for the soil to warm them. She is unaware that a foot may crush them or a wild animal break them. She acts as if the eggs were not hers and is unconcerned, and her efforts are wasted. And in fact, the eggs may well not have been hers. The male had several partners, other people's children, and they were all deposited in the same nest. There is a major hen who he is loosely shacked up with, and the others are one-night stands. They all leave the eggs in the nest together, and they have no further role in rearing the young. The major hen makes sure that her eggs are in the center, while leaving the other eggs on the rim, which is open to vulture attack. And in the Bible, ostriches represent desolation, ruin, destruction, depopulation, a loss of hope that no one will ever live there again. And yet now that changes. They are in their normal environment and blessed by God, despite the fact that they are unclean. The Hebrew word for ostrich means greediness. The Asian ostrich of the Bible land, however, became extinct in 1966, which is why this image is depicted as a skeleton. Now, I'm not sure whether it was Loret or Duret who pointed out at the watch night service, Daddy, ostriches are still alive. And they are quite right. But it is the African ostrich, not its cousin, the Asian ostrich, which joins a host of other species in this age of mass extinction. Jackal means howler. The golden jackal is more often an opportunist. He's a Jack the Lad, or Jack the Jackal, often hunting in pairs. They are not solitary animals, and sometimes they move in extended family groups of eight or dozens of jackals together at major food sources, particularly at rubbish dumps. They scavenge, they clean up, including bodies on battlefields. They communicate with howls, barks, growls, whines, cackles, yelps. Jackals are unloved. And there are plenty of people on the margins who make us fearful and afraid, that are difficult to love, like jackals, and others we despise, like ostriches. But instead of remembrance, there is hope. And that hope in 2019 continues as God makes a way through the wilderness in the power of the Spirit. To walk on that way will need God's Spirit, and the wilderness is transformed as God touches it to include and bless those who are on the margins. And to illustrate this is to watch for the new thing, and that means to walk by faith. Now, an example of another desert dweller is found in Hebrews 11, the desert nomad called Abraham. And although originally a townie, he became a tent man, someone who was personally obedient to what God asked of him, a spontaneous response to God's call, but traveling on the way where he did not know where God was calling him. There were no roadmaps in his desert, but he accepted the reality of an inheritance built on trust, not knowing where that would be. So Abram left behind the seen world of the town of Ur into the unseen world of the desert, perhaps an unseen promise where he trusted God, who made the promise that it would become a reality even though he could not yet see it. And it requires faith, but it also requires hope, and it also requires trust, and trust is the language of love. It wasn't just Abraham on his own, but the emergence of a community that continued to follow by faith, in this case Isaac and Jacob, as a growing family and attendants followed over the generations, believing in the same promise, dwelling as strangers, not as owners, tenacious tenants in tenuous circumstances. A community that continued to believe in a reality that was not immediately apparent, but seeing it as a stable, permanent hope that went beyond the material things that they had in front of them. Now, the rivers and the streams that God will provide in the desert, although they are yet unseen, they are coming. And a desert, by definition, is as dry as a bone. There's no water in it. Faith looks at the horizon that sees beyond the immediate realities and walks in the light of that into a future whose architect is God, who not only designs that future, but is also building it. It's not a haphazard series of events, but it is a future designed and built by God. Faith gives substance to our hope. The title deeds of things hoped for, as Paul writes in the Romans in the Imperial City, for it was by hope that we are saved. But if we see what we hope for, that is not really hope. For who hopes for something he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Now, an illustration of this story of this water in the desert, I think can be found in Acts chapter 8. And it's the encounter between Philip and the Ethiopian official. The official was a God-fearing accountant, most likely a Gentile and a eunuch, leaving for home in Africa after a trip to Jerusalem. And as a eunuch, he would never have been able to be admitted into the community of faith as it has been previously understood. Yet in God's new reality breaking in, he gains a place because God is already preparing his heart. It is a reminder that this is God's mission, not ours. We are invited to join him in the deserts. He is already preparing to receive the water of life. The official needs a guide, and that guide was Philip, who was willing to step out in faith to journey on a road past a ruined city where he didn't really know where he was going or why he was there. A road that even by the time Acts was written was no longer in use. A desert road out in the Gaza desert. It is in response to the Ethiopian's genuine faith that the Ethiopian is incorporated into God's pilgrim people. By the public profession of that faith and the waters of baptism there in the desert, he discovers Jesus, fellowship, commitment, community. For Philip, it is the discovery that God is moving his people beyond borders. It is not the official's foreignness, nor his blackness, nor his being a Gentile, nor his being a eunuch that can prevent his inclusion amongst the people of God found by the waters in the desert. And it is worth reminding ourselves that the Ethiopian church has lasted much longer in Africa than before the white people came, before Islam came. It has been continuously present longer than Christianity came to these shores in the British Isles. It has continuously been present in Ethiopia since the time of the apostles. God giving streams in the desert, rivers in dry places, giving water to my chosen people. They are the people I made for myself, and they will sing my praises. God is still in the business of greening deserts and including the excluded. Watch for the new things that God is doing.